You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, welcome everybody. It's really nice to meet you. Of course, we're here to talk about King Kirby, the stage play turned into podcast created by Fred Van Lente and Crystal Skillman. We have the entire cast of the original performance here to talk about this. My name is Rob Salkowitz. I am a writer and sayer of things about comics. I am senior media and entertainment contributor at Forbes. I write for other publications and teach at University of Washington. Most of all, I'm a lifelong comics fan. My life was changed forever reading the work of Jack Kirby when I was a kid. And like a lot of people that are in the comics side of things, known about Jack Kirby my whole life, and the story of how Jack Kirby and his genius was kind of eclipsed and pushed out of the way by his collaborators and by the business of comics, which is kind of built on an Indian's graveyard of injustice and historical expropriation of creators. It's been a terrible story, and it's gotten more terrible because of how big these properties have gotten. That what was once originally, you know, just hit comic book series, this big being the basis of toys and games, and now multi-billion dollar movies and the center of a global entertainment industry. And the people that created that, like Jack Kirby, the powerful imaginations that came up with these stories, their full story has never really been told. So when King Kirby came out, I saw the play performed actually in Seattle in 2014 and was really thought that it was great to take the inside story of what people who know comics history know to be the truth about how Kirby was treated and start bringing that to a mass audience was a really important thing to do. So I was inspired by it then, and I'm really glad to see that it's getting a revival in public interest right now. So, and if you haven't heard it, you're in for a treat. Check out the podcast. They're extremely well done. But first I want to begin with Fred and Crystal and just ask you, how did this project come about and how did it sort of harmonize your two creative skills to bring this to the stage?
Well, I was always really into Marvel Comics. I sort of grew up reading the original Stan and Jack stuff in reprint form. And I only heard about Jack Kirby sort of after the fact once I was in college. I mean, I knew he was, but I just thought he was sort of the sidekick to Stan Lee because that's sort of what the public perception was. And then like a lot of adolescence, once I found out the story was BS, I got all pissed off and started researching it really heavily. And then I discovered, as listeners of the podcast have found out and readers of the play have found out, that his life really encompassed the whole of America in the 20th century. He grew up in the Jewish ghetto. He fought in World War II. He did the romance comics in the 50s. He did the psychedelic work in the 60s. And I just thought it was a really sort of Shakespearean sort of experience with that would really make for a great story. Initially, I was doing a biography, but I was in my 20s and kind of like never finishing anything. And I was dating this lovely playwright at the time. And I was like, she's writing plays.
Who was that?
I don't know. Some lady. And I was like, she's writing plays. I can do that too. And so I wrote a draft of the play. We thought it was pretty good, but we did a reading of it, but there was really no venue for it in like, this is like 2002, I want to say. I think the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies had just come out.
Yep.
But it kind of got put in a drawer until Crystal, who later married me, much to her chagrin. you learned about
because of the play.
Because, well, I hope there's more to it than that.
No.
Then you got approached by the Comic Book Theater Festival, right?
Yes, the Brick Theater, which really kind of launched me in Brooklyn. Jeff Lawanzik and Hope, they were doing these great festivals, and when they came up with the comic book one, they were very excited, and they were like, Fred Wright's comics, and does he have anything? I was like, well, this is perfect. And you know, as we started to do the final tweaks too, we realized a bit before that we were working the play together, and then we really kind of joined forces. And actually initially it was very interesting because the first time we were supposed to do it,
well, what happened was, is I was working for Marvel exclusively at the time writing comics. This is after I sort of went pro after first doing all this research, and I was doing a comic book called Compa Comics. Now I've said the comics too many times in one sentence, where we dealt with Jack Kirby suing to get his artwork back, which is the subject of the climax of the play, yeah. And the Marvel business and legal people were very unhappy with me and calling up and threatening me that they're going to cancel my contract and stuff. And so at the time I told Crystal, let's put this in the drawer again and see if they don't do another comic book theater festival.
Yeah. And it was really, I think for all artists, like a real, including Jack, a lot of his stories about creating over and over again and getting up and making the next superhero and doing the next work.
And so, and I should point out the heirs had just started suing Marvel at that point. So the Marvel was all on edge and freaked out.
So when that happened, and I remember distinctly, it's that you never forget certain moments because I was so excited about this upcoming production we had just talked about. And I was brushing my teeth. Like I really remember. And I remember the phone call that you got, because when you hear a phone call like that on the other side, it's just very chilling because it's very clearly.
Oh, yeah, right.
The phone call, it's very Marvel, clearly, yeah. Someone saying, I could tell what the phone call, the nature of the phone call was. And so
if you've never been threatened by large corporations, people, you haven't lived.
Yeah, it's not fun for anybody. But the comic book theater, that Roger Nasser, bless his soul, who helped out with these festivals, he called me up and he said, oh my God, that's awful. And I was like, I know, Roger, I know, but we really can't. We have to figure this out. We need to give some time. And he's like, oh, if only Fred had written more comics. I was like, huh. And it's like, and only if we could take one of those and adapt it into something. And I was like, And Fred had Action Philosophers. So we actually bought time for the play of King Kirby. By first doing the play of Action Philosophers. And after that, it gained traction. And that died down for you with Marvel. Right. Then we, the festival happened.
They skipped a year.
Yeah. So they did it again. So it was the second time that we brought King Kirby
And I should say that in Crystal pulled out the script that was 10 years old at this point and rewrote a bunch of it. And she's like, why don't you do this? I was like, you're the co-writer. Congratulations.
Yeah. It was a beautiful gift. My name was on it when I got it back. And I thought that was lovely. And the biggest shift I always talk about, like what was the huge shift? And something I was realizing as a writer myself is we had to first immerse people into the world of Kirby and the characters and the fiction. And for anyone, I think, who wasn't in the inn, it was a little bit exciting, but alienating, and perhaps we were giving away too much too soon. And so I suggested doing the flip, that we start with the reality and the stakes of what's going on with Kirby at that time. And then we both came up with the idea of him drawing at that table from when he first walked in.
And we cast these lovely actors and we had a wonderful run in Brooklyn. And the week I think the show opened, Marvel settled with the Kirby heirs because the Supreme Court had threatened to take up the case. And so Disney, which had bought Marvel at this point were like, this is not worth a big fight. So that's why you now, thank goodness, see Jack in the beginning, you know, was credited with co-creation and all the Marvel movies and all that stuff. Happy ending.
Now you remind me that I have been remiss in my moderator's duties for introducing the panel. And I would actually ask you guys to sort of go around and introduce yourselves, because we have the entire cast here. And if you just sort of introduce yourself and say who you portray in the play. And let's start with Stephen.
Oh, hi. Hi, everybody. I'm Steve Rattazzi. I'm an actor. And I had the great joy to play Jack Kirby in King Kirby.
And how about Nat?
Hey, I'm Nat Cassidy, and I play Stan Lee, among some other very fun roles.
Awesome. Amy?
Hi, I'm Amy Lee Pearsall, and I play Roz Kirby and others.
Joe?
Joe Mathers. I had the good fortune to be able to play Joe Simon and others.
And finally, Tim.
Hi, I'm Timothy. I played various sort of adversaries in Jack Kirby's life. George Patton, Martin Goodman, Frederick Wortham, and Fellini, who wasn't quite an adversary, but was definitely there momentarily.
Definitely an obstacle.
Yeah.
And then we also have the audio, the sound producer for the podcast series. Bobby, wanted to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Bobby Cronin. I wrote the score and did all the sound editing and sound design for the audio drama.
So just to start with you, Bobby, a quick question. Was it, what we're hearing on the podcast is the actual recording of the performance of the play. Was it a challenge to adapt it, to sort of move from the theater of butts and seats to the theater of the mind? What sort of went into adapting that?
It was just really fun to do it. I've worked on a lot of film before, and I mostly make my career writing musicals, and I had never done something like this. And so it was a really good exercise for my brain, but I realized that my job was to make sure that at any moment the audience is listening, that they understand where we are, what is happening, what the drive of the story is. And, you know, when Crystal and Fred approached me and they said, I know about their play, King Kirby, and when they said it was King Kirby, I was like, I get to write a superhero theme song. Yes, this is so cool. And it, I mean, I just had a really great time doing it. But it was, you know, because it was a live piece, I was able to, you know, I could play with timing. I could stretch out a scene. I could make a scene faster if I felt that the drive needed to go. So I kind of used a bit of a director brain in there as well.
Very cool. Well, it sounds great. And it really, as you say, it really puts you in the sense of place for all of it. It's a very, very well done thing. And just an open question for all of the cast. Did any of you guys know much about Jack Kirby or, you know, the sort of the comics biz side of things that were portrayed in this play before you became involved in this project?
I'd like to say something. But before we move on to that, I just have to say, I listened to all of Bobby's work on the podcast right before this interview, and it is astonishing. It is absolutely so much fun, and your music is absolutely amazing.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
What a wonderful job. You just did, and it's very hard. I know we did this recording, but we really came from a theatrical place with this piece. And it's very rare to see this kind of creation from a theatrical base. And I just thought it was just expertly done and just so much fun. And I just wanted to say that before we move on.
Here.
No, I was saying to Fred and Crystal before we started that I was listening to the podcast at the gym earlier today. And I was so engrossed in it that I lost track of how many reps I was doing and I almost hurt myself.
Uh-oh, are you okay?
yeah, it was, it definitely puts you in the mindset of where you are and really brings those characters out as well. So back to the question, was anybody here, you know, pre-existing, you know, Kirby or Marvel maven before this, or, you know, were you surprised at all by what you discovered about that relationship in the performance here?
I personally was familiar into comics from way back, and I guess was familiar with the backstage drama. Not all the details like about relationship with Roz, or you know, his own Jack Kirby's personal details, but the comic side of things and who the characters were, definitely.
And anybody else, or is this just sort of an Amy, you've got a thought?
I was just gonna say, honestly, in terms of Jack Kirby's work, as somebody who enjoyed watching animated films and the superhero films, I honestly had no idea about who Jack Kirby was, any of his contributions to the field. Really my entry drug, if you will, as for many other people to the story of Jack Kirby, was Michael Chabon's book that was inspired by his life, The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. And I loved that book. I was like, and then somebody was like, oh yeah, it's about this guy. And I'm like, who's this guy? And, you know, so that kind of started going down that hole. And when Fred and Crystal and Jack Hurley, who was the director of the stage production, you know, reached out and asked me to come in and read, I was like, heck yes. So that was really how I came into this.
Have any of you guys, did you had the chance to meet either Jack or Roz when they were alive? I know that Jack died in what, 91, 92, something like that, and Roz died in 97.
No, but I was in an elevator in London with Stan Lee once.
Yeah. High school me would have been super excited to have met Jack Kirby, but it did not happen.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, you really evoke these characters. Did you research? I mean, did you listen to recordings, and did you do anything to sort of capture their true life personalities in your portrayals, particularly Stephen and Matt and Amy, because those characters' voices, to a certain extent, were kind of known to the public, especially Stan Lee.
Yeah, I it was interesting because and to answer your previous question too, I knew of the name Jack Kirby, like I knew of the name Steve Ditko, like I just knew these names, but I knew Stan Lee. Like Stan Lee was the icon that I was familiar with whenever I thought of Marvel, which I was a fan of growing up, but I tended to stick more to, I was like a DC and Dark Horse comics fan, and I would dabble in Marvel from time to time. I liked the X-Men. But so I wasn't that familiar with anything about the story. Like, I think I knew there was a little bit of controversy and probably some authorship questions and all that stuff, but that's kind of inherent in most industries like this. So I was, you know, I didn't know the details. And so what was fascinating to me working on this was, I almost got to work from that outside in sort of place, because I knew the public persona of Stan Lee, and Stan Lee is such a cultivator of public persona. That's one of his greatest gifts. So it was interesting to kind of deconstruct that and work almost backwards from that point, to the point where like the voice was one of the first things I kind of obsessed with getting right, because it's such a such an iconic, recognizable voice. Mm-hmm. And in a weird way, like I don't think I necessarily like recreate the voice. Like I don't think it entirely sounds exactly like him mimic wise, but I was trying to find that energy behind it, that always on stage sort of energy behind it, to kind of show the voice with a capital V, not like the nitty gritty details.
Well, of course, Kirby first meets Stan Lee when he's 17, when Stan Lee is 17 years old, and he's just a kid working in the office, you know, and annoying everybody. So this is Stan before he was anybody. Yeah. So you had the challenge of sort of recreating that, you know, to let everybody know that this person is eventually going to grow up to become Stan Lee, but at that moment he's just an annoying 17-year-old kid. So Stephen, you had, of course, the meaty title part here, and Kirby is such a complex and fascinating guy, because he's on one hand, this visionary creator with all of these big ideas in his head, and yet he's like this very down-to-earth blue-collar guy. You know, he's like tough on some things and very scrappy, but then he's intimidated by, you know, people in suits and things. Like he's kind of a bundle of contradictions. I'm just kind of curious, how did you approach that complexity in your performance, and what are the things about Kirby's personality that resonated with you that you wanted to really bring out?
I'm going to continue this theme of not answering your question, but going back to something. I just have to say, this show, when Fred told me this was, what did you say, what year was this?
2014.
It just blew my mind. I was like, wait, 6 years? What? It's all kind of a fog. So it was really amazing to listen to the new podcast. And I have to say, Nat, you really, really captured the spirit of Stan Lee. That's really kind of amazing. I went, wait, that's Stan Lee. I said, no, it's not exactly the quality of the voice. It's just the persona. And even being the young 17-year-old kid, that scene, it's so great. And then just the progression over the show. It's just wonderful. And everyone, I have to say, everyone does such great work on the show. It was such a joy doing the production. But then to hear everyone's voices, and it's such great work each of the actors have done. And I have to say, I just cracked up laughing at so many parts, but I just love Fellini so much. Tim, your Fellini is so much fun. That character just pops out of nowhere and just makes me laugh.
Anyway, Tim, I have to say that a big quote in our household is, we're like a very much like a comic.
That's hilarious.
It's so great, but everyone did such great work. Yeah, I was trying to remember back because, you know, a lot has happened.
Yes.
Just last week.
Just in this past day. But yeah, I remember doing a lot of research, and there is a lot of also video and audio of Jack Kirby, which also helps you to kind of capture, again, not trying to do his voice per se, but capture that character. But yeah, you're just drawn to this story. I mean, Fred and Christy did such a great job capturing it. I think just reading your script alone, you just really empathize with this character, Rob, which you described very well. So I just really connected with that kind of, and I'm a Brooklyn, I'm a Bay Ridge boy. So I do remember doing a lot of research beforehand, trying to capture it. But then, as happens sometimes in productions, and probably casting as a big issue with this, everything just started to click. And we all just started to work together and feed off each other. And it was just a great production team as well. So that helps.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
And I do realize it's been a while for you guys, so pardon my digging into the past here, but for people that are tuning in and going to listen to this podcast, it's going to seem like just yesterday. So, Joe, you have the role of Joe Simon, who is somebody that is maybe known to the more inside comics people, but a less familiar collaborator with Jack Kirby than Stan Lee was. Tell us a little bit about that character and how you, and basically your background in this project and how you came to it.
Being involved in the project, I have done a number of different plays that Crystal has written. So I was very familiar with her work. And Timothy and I were in Action Philosophers together. I love doing Crystal's work. I love doing her plays. She's got great stuff, and I'm a huge fan of Fred's work. From many companies, and I'm an old comic book nerd myself. I mean, not Dark Horse, Marvel, and even Now Comics. That was when Fright Night was a big go-to for me when they had that title.
Wow, you're dropping the Now Comics references.
Oh yeah, hey, it's what they had at the convenience store. but for me coming into look at this character of Joe Simon, the research I did was, you know, being aware that a co-creator of Captain America and Steve Rogers and Bucky, and different version of Bucky than in the films, but like, what I did was, because I didn't have the ability to really get a good lock on what he sounded like. And I wasn't able to find a lot of material where he was so public, because I think he also made a huge transition in his personal life and his career, where I think Jack had this creative energy that just couldn't be contained. And he would just fight through everything he could to keep doing what he loved doing. I feel like Joe hit a point where he was just like, it's not fun for me anymore. I'm gonna stop. And he kind of disappeared out of like the public eye from the comics standpoint. After a certain point, he was just like, I'm gonna go do advertising where I can go home to my family and be happy. And I don't wanna, I'm good. I made my money. So my process, a lot of it was I looked at as many pictures, images, photos of Joe Simon, just because I find that when trying to figure out how a character lives on stage, I like to look at how they move. And so photos and images are really helpful to me, because you can see how their posture is. And he's had this really sort of interesting way of holding his upper body very stiffly. But he was, you know, in the photos, he also seems very relaxed. So it was like, all right, this is a guy who I feel like plays the suit game really well, but would get along with Jack Kirby phenomenally, because they have a similar background, because they have similar ideas, they have similar tastes. For me, a lot of the process was literally just watching what Steven was doing and going, how can I offer a counterpoint to that rhythmically and physically in the space, which, you know, you're not really going to get in a podcast, but I think vocally, I mean, like, you know, Steven has a timbre and a speed at which he delivers his lines. So I was like, Joe Simon needs to be a little bit held back from that. And then, you know, kind of figuring that kind of stuff out, then leaves me go like, how hard is he thinking about everything? And is he two steps ahead of Jack Kirby, or is he three behind and just really smooth at keeping up? And I think that for me, that was a lot of that damage. It was a non-competitive, but a desire to be on Jack's level, I think. It's kind of how I wanted to play.
I mean, the dynamic between the two of them was really interesting, because they were, as you say, I always picture them a little bit like Abbott and Costello, you know, and it's like, you know, that Kirby was the sort of scrappy, you know, guy, and Joe was a little more the sort of smooth, polished. But as you say, they had a lot in common.
I'm remembering, you know, just talking about this 2014. I'm remembering that our wonderful costume designer just went above and beyond the Call of Duty, and she just came up with these voluminous binders of period photos of our major characters, and just walked into the first rehearsal with it, and I was like, damn.
Holly and Merrill, yeah.
Holly and Merrill, they knocked that out of the park. They had ample reference for everybody. It was pretty incredible.
We might see some of that on the Insta, but it was wonderful to
on
see.
On the gram.
It was wonderful as an author to see when you walked in your costumes. It really was. It was an incredible moment. And I remember so many conversations too about the spirit of the characters. And Steve and I remember a lot of talk about that too, because... And I got so excited about that. And I think I heard so much from the audience. They were like, he was Jack, but he brought a new dimension to him. And we heard a lot about that for each of the characters, which was so great, because, you know, I don't know, maybe, you know, I always have an interesting view of what's commercial and all those sorts of things. But at the same time, I didn't see this as a bioplay. I saw this as a play that tells his story, but it is a play. And what is that? And so it was exciting to see how much they responded to these creative interpretations that clearly were these characters, but they weren't by no means imitating these real life people.
I never met Jack Kirby in person, but the first year I was at San Diego Comic-Con was 1997. And I was, you know, a kid in a candy shop, and I found an original Jack Kirby sketch, what I thought was an original Jack Kirby sketch, at an art dealer that I bought for probably as much money as I had brought to the show. But I thought, oh, this is a one chance to, I can own this piece. So I took it over to the table of a fanzine called the Jack Kirby Collector to show these guys, like, hey, look what I got. And they were looking at it. They said, I don't know that this is a Kirby original. Like, you should, you know, I don't... And so Roz Kirby, who was still alive at that time, was sitting at the table, and she looks at it and she's like, where did you get this? And I said, over at this guy. She, you know, show me who sold you this piece. So I go over there and I said, you know, I said to the dealer, I said, I just bought this I have reason to believe that it may not be authentic. He said, what do you mean you have reason to believe it's not authentic? I said, well, talk to this lady. And Roz is in a wheelchair, and she says, you give this young man his money back. That is not my husband's work. And it's like the piece like disappeared behind the desk. He like counts out the money, he said, go away. That was my one and only encounter with Roz Kirby, and she passed away shortly thereafter.
Wow.
But Amy, that listening to you capture that character, and also the enduring relationship, like a lot of Jack Kirby's story is bittersweet, not the Jack and Roz story. That's 100% sweet. Like, they found each other, they found soulmates in each other. I mean, there's a question here somewhere. Just talk about that chemistry and how you kind of captured that and brought that to life, I guess.
Well, going back to Crystal's mentioning Holly Rinn, our costume designer, bringing in all of those photographs. It was such a treat to me to see, you know, their family photographs. They were just very, very free with one another, very easy. It was clear, you know, that they had a lot of fun, that there was an enormous amount of love there and an enormous amount of respect. And in my own personal research on Roz, I was lucky, thank you, internet, to find a number of interviews that she actually did when she was older. You know, she sat down and the young whippersnappers came out and asked Roz questions, and she was only too happy to talk about, you know, how she met Jack in Brooklyn when her family moved in and rented out the apartment upstairs. And his actual pickup to her was, do you want to come up and look at my etchings? And I'm like, he did not, but he did. And that was the first time she saw Captain America. And she was apparently very disappointed that he didn't try anything funny, but no, he was a complete gentleman. But she was an enormous champion of his creative work. She was very loyal to him. She took the lumps that he took in equal measure, and she took it very personally, and she wanted to protect him because, you know, Jack was a very creative person. And I think, as many creatives do, you know, we just put our stuff out there. We just want our stuff to be out there. We want it to be loved. And we don't necessarily think about how it's going to be protected. And, you know, Jack was, to his credit, you know, he was trying to do right by his family. You know, he had four kids. He was trying to win back these 88 pages or whatever it was, you know, so he could have something to pass along to his kids. But at the end of the day, you know, Roz was like, you're not thinking about legacy, you know, you're not, it was really, really hard. And I guess I saw, that's how I tend, when I love people, that's how I tend to love people, you know, kind of fiercely and kind of like that rabid dog, you know, what are you doing? For better or worse. So that was, I guess that was something in Roz, the character of Roz, that I tried to bring some of myself to, if that answers your question at all.
Oh, that's good. That's great. I mean, you know, again, it's been a while for you guys, and did, you know, in listening to the shows, you know, as they've been redone for this podcast, did you hear anything in there, either in your own performances or in your cast members' performances, that surprised you or was like, wow, that was really cool, or I'd forgotten that? Was there anything that sort of jumped out and surprised and delighted you for rediscovering it?
A lot of the dialogue, just the writing and the dialogue. Like, there are things that every one of these characters says that just hit like a ton of bricks. Like, there's just moments where like just somebody has like the line, you know, maybe we should start with the villain. Like, I love that line. That has stuck with me, and hearing it again is like, God, that's great. That's just cool.
Yeah, it's such a an economical piece. It covers so much ground, and it covers it so swiftly without giving anything short shrift at all. And it was, I kind of forgot about how efficient and just a freight train the momentum could be. It was a very interesting experience recording this, and I think you can kind of hear it in the recording on the dialogue side, because we, you know, audio dramas are you know, experiencing kind of a renaissance right now, and it's this thing that is becoming more and more prevalent. But we recorded this around a table in a comic book shop after hours, you know, basically with one take, just with a bunch of mics in front of us, coming off of the production that we had just done. So it has the efficiency, and I should say John Hurley is also just he's big on momentum as well. So it was a great fit, him with this piece, creating this incredibly streamlined narrative that goes from you know, a kid on the streets of Brooklyn to the Mets battlefield in World War II to the 70s and auction houses and litigation about intellectual property. Like, there's so much sweep. And what is it, 80 minutes, 70 minutes? Like, it's such a...
And we were contractually obligated from the Comic Book Theater Festival because we've all done theater festivals, right? There was a show after us and a show before us. So we had to get in, do our stunt thing and get out before we got yelled at. And I want to say our contract was for 75 minutes.
Yeah, it's 75. Yeah.
That feels right.
And the podcast is a bit longer.
You can feel that though in the dialogue, I think. You can feel the this is a group of actors who have this in their bones now. It's not the beginning of a run sort of vibe. It is the, yeah, let's get back together after the run and just kind of fall back into doing this piece. And so, like, some of it is the fact that it has been 1,000 years since we did it, that makes it kind of interesting to listen to. But I think some of it too is just recapturing, getting to recapture that feeling of just this group, this small group. I even forget how small this cast is because there's so many characters, but just hearing five people clicking together, almost running on autopilot because they've got this show in their bones. That was a blast to hear again.
I honestly forgot how many characters Timothy played. Like, and I was like, oh, he kind of is a glue holding the whole show together.
As everybody else, yeah.
And each character has like five lines. Like, they're so memorable in such a short time, and everybody's performances is so delineated and well wrought that you only need like 5 seconds of stage time, and there's a character.
Yeah, run through who your pantheon. Like, you played sort of course you played Martin Goodman, who despite his name is not a good man. And lots of other
Jack Lieber from DC, right? That was his name.
Jack Liebowitz, another
Liebowitz. Yeah, that's it. Lieber, Liebowitz on either side of the distinguished competition. Patton. Frederick Wertham, Fellini, of course. Those are kind of the main named characters.
Fox.
Well, with Wertham,
right? Fox, right, as well, right.
I'm king of the comics.
Right, yeah.
You're the comics, boys.
Now, with Wertham, you're actually reproducing a historical, like, I've actually heard Wertham say some of the words that you said in there in terms of talking about how comics contribute to delinquency and his whole shtick. Were you familiar with that person at all?
The Seduction of the Innocent. Yeah, I was familiar with it, but I didn't really dig in until we worked on the project.
And the Wortham bit, what's cool about this, Tim, is that was sort of an interesting thing doing the podcast, because Bobby, I don't know if you remember, but in the original draft of that episode, you had Wortham speaking in this kind of giant, Tim's voice was kind of echoing out in this big empty hall. But I, being the huge comic historian nerd I am, know that that was in the Foley Courthouse in Manhattan, which was this room jam-packed with people. And I was like, oh, why don't I just show Bobby I forgot I had actual film of Wortham literally doing this.
Right.
So I just sent it him, and you were just like, done. And I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. But it's just so stunning to me how, because it's the same recording, Tim, it's Tim's same performance from Midtown Comics, but with two completely different vocal treatments, you get a totally different sound space, which I feel naive that I did not realize that was the power of changing those, that timbre and that audio, you know?
What's really fun is that we both love rewriting so much. But one thing sometimes sections would go, but very rarely would a whole entire section go. Although sometimes we talked about it. So Wortham, when the Wortham section started, we just found it so fascinating. I think it was taking up like 10 minutes. It was becoming like the Wortham show. And they were like, how do we? And then.
But it wasn't. It was the fact it was in this big empty room. And so we didn't cut a line.
Oh, no, but
narrowed the space.
In the play.
In
terms of how we got to the script. But in the original script, we had like maybe 4 hours of rehearsal time. That was all Wortham. We were like, you know, dealing with, it was the Wortham show.
How was that staged in person? Because it sounds so seamless on the podcast. It sounds like it was actually written for audio, you know, for an audio play, because of the way that it kind of cuts in and out. I mean, are Kirby and Simon on stage and Wortham is in the, you know, like you changing the spotlight or something? Because that was really interesting.
I think that's right. Because didn't you have to bring your own chair out, Tim?
Yeah, I think so. I was down left, I remember.
My first time to go off stage for a second.
Right.
Okay.
The whole thing really moves. So, it's John Hurley's staging genius, the facile alacrity of the script being really much like a comic book. I mean, it's got like what everything that and said about what's in it, it is jam-packed and is exciting and is economically written and is fully written as a comic book, so that it had the momentum and performance, so that when with these moments of rest, you know, particularly Jack's emotional beats and Jack and Ross's emotional beats, they really earn those pauses, because everything else is like morphing and it really replicates the brilliance of Kirby's imagination, I think.
And it's real indie theater, you know, that was in terms of the physicality of the space. We love the brick, but it's the brick. And so,
right.
I think we were rehearsing in a space much shinier. So
mm-hmm. That's right. We were. I forgot about
we
that.
We were in a very shiny space.
Right. So
where was that? That was the Whatchamadoodles
over by the,
yeah, it was a brand new like theater complex.
Yeah. Right.
And then we moved to a garage to actually do the show.
and so there, and of course, and this happens. I have the musical I'm working on with Bobby. I'm working on a few pieces with Bobby, but Mary Max, the musical we work on together. But he knows, man, I always say, you know, no, this time not no props, you know, and that's not going to happen. So Fred, but also in my defense, Fred really likes hats and wigs.
You asked me what's the heart of theater? Funny hats.
He really likes hats.
Hats. Just wear different hats.
But so with the props in this, in terms of the physicality too and movement.
Lost in podcast, though, unfortunately. You can't do that on audio drama.
Right. But within the actual production in the black box, you know, it's hard to distinguish lighting in that way. You know what I mean? You have to really work hard at it. And John worked really hard with the designers. And of course, on a festival plot and all these sorts of things. So the fact that
really
the actors could,
technical
yeah, distinguish in these moments, move seamlessly, was really exciting. But also the pages, that was one of the things I remember we talked about so much. And Steve and I remember you just, you know, wow, that tracking you know, plot of these props that were, when are the pages blank? When are they now a sketch? When is it now inked? When is it now? And sometimes you're following the actually the progression of one whole piece, which we had artist friends provide yes. art for the sequence. And so Dean Haspel was a great supporter of the show, Riley Brown. So this play was blessed by the comic book community in many ways. And you could feel that energy in the piece. What's fun about it, coming back to it, when we did it both at the comic book Midtown Comics, but also now as an official audio drama writer doing audio drama, I can say, gosh, how cool is it that I love that physicality, but that we can move, and Bobby through music can bring us so seamless. This really was born for audio. Like it comes alive in just the voices and us inferring the movement. And one of my favorite new things is that in the production, when you walked in, you would, Stephen as Kirby was at his drawing table.
On stage,
drawing.
Yeah.
And I find it so moving. And he's also speaking from, you know, basically beyond the grave, because the auction of his work is happening at the same time. And he says, stop, I don't want to hear that number. It's, you know, I don't want to hear that when you're gone, which is something that you'll be hearing when you listen to the show. But there was, and this show only played for 8 performances, the audience reaction, some people had studied Kirby all their lives. There was one girl who was 25 and she burst into tears and she couldn't stop crying when she saw Stephen as Jack drawing. And there were these, you know, visceral reactions to feeling like they were with Jack either. And then people grabbing me after being like, I didn't know that this is where Captain America came from. Captain America changed my life. And now this man has changed my life. And so there was so much emotion and reaction, both from people who were diehard fans of all ages, genders, race, whether you were really into the comics or not. So that's something that always kept pushing me about the project. One thing I love about the audio drama that you'll hear is how Bobby has scored that and how you're going to feel like you're right there with Jack drawing. And I find it very, just as emotional as the visual. And I think that's one of the fun of audio, is how can you capture something so visual just through sound, so you can now imagine it for yourself.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Now, when you guys, you were saying that this play was a long time coming between the time that you originally conceived of it and it came to the stage, and all during that time, you know, there was this kind of dramatic irony of the fact that we, the audience, or the people that were in tune with this situation, if you heard of Marvel characters, you know, 99 people out of 100, if you asked them who created these characters, they would say, well, Stan Lee created these characters. And so, you know, you were either part of the misinformed public about it, or you were aware of the injustice that what became of Jack Kirby subsequently was that he was, you know, sort of swept under the rug of the official story of the birth of Marvel. And then by the time the play saw the light of day, you said Kirby's last appeal was getting adjudicated by the Supreme Court. And you said that eventually Disney caved in and settled with him because they didn't want to even take the chance, because there were so many copyright law things at issue in that settlement. They didn't want to even have the Supreme Court weigh in on it, because it would screw up all of Disney's business model. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, in the Kirby battle was something they inherited from Marvel before they bought Marvel. So it wasn't even a fight they had started.
No, it's generations of work to say that Marvel and Marvel's employee Stan Lee created these characters.
Right.
So since that time, since 2014, and after that settlement, now Kirby's name appears on all of the Marvel properties across all of the media. The Kirby family got what is reportedly a very generous settlement. And meanwhile, you know, Stan Lee's stock has kind of fallen, especially in the tragic last year of his life, which was not so good. And then since his demise in 2018, you know, the the fact that he's not here to speak for himself anymore and his gigantic avuncular media personality is no longer present on the scene, we can kind of get more objective. Do you feel like Kirby's legacy, that we're finally getting some true balance and perspective into, you know, Kirby's contribution to this and his reputation, or do you feel like we still have a ways to go on that?
You know, what's funny is I probably would have given a different answer to this in 2014 than I have now. And partly that's just because I've been doing a lot of, I'm currently right now doing a history of animation. I'm doing history of role-playing games. And you see in sort of business life and entertainment life, this theme keeps showing up. Like, who created Apple, Steve Jobs or Steve Wozniak? Who created Mickey Mouse? Was it Ubiworks or Walt Disney? Who created Dungeons and Dragons? Was it Dave Arneson or Gary Gygax? You have these dichotomies repeating over and over and over again. I think it's partly because it's hard for us to think about things beyond the auteur level, beyond like a singular creator level. But I also think it's because what ends up happening in these kinds of relationships is there is sort of a dominant, there's sort of an alpha and a beta, you know? And what ends up happening almost invariably, you know, Walt Disney and I don't know if anyone in this call has ever even heard of Ubiworks, but Walt Disney is such a dominant personality that he just kind of overwhelms everything else. So I think it's a doomed prospect in the sense of Jack Kirby ever becoming equal to Stan Lee, but I do think that it's improving. Yeah, I do.
You want to strive for the Ben and Jerry model.
That's right.
Well, there's a biography of Stan Lee that's coming out this month.
Abraham's book. Yeah.
Abraham Reitzman's book called True Believer, where he said, you know, he's investigated this pretty thoroughly. And his answer on this is, we can't rule out the possibility that Jack Kirby did in fact create all of this stuff as he's claimed. That there's nothing in the history of Stan Lee that fully substantiates Stan Lee's claim to being the co-creator of this to the extent that Jack Kirby was, which is very
right. Well, I mean, you know, Nat has this line in the play, which is something Stan repeatedly, which is that he changed his name because he wanted to write the great American novel. But for someone who's sort of known as being a writer, you know, the obvious question anyone would ask would be, where are the manuscripts? You know what I mean? Like, if you're a writer and that's primarily your job, we have 1-2-page outline about that's supposedly the first Fantastic Four story, which looks nothing, reads nothing like what the actual Fantastic Four story was. And to a certain extent, we dramatize that in the play where Steven says, this is a little thin. I'm going to have to, you know, flesh this out. So, you know, I mean, Stan sort of going on pure personality. And I guess I take the opposite sort of view from what Abraham is talking about, although what he says makes perfect sense to me as well, is that there's no, you know, evidence that he didn't just, you know, talk to the letterer and do the dialogue after the pages came in. And the question is, what level of authorial intention do you ascribe to that? You know,
there's a line in the show too, that I thought was really illustrative and made a lot of sense to me, dramatizing the conflict, the authorship conflict, which was that Kirby says something to the effect of, like, he gives me the premise and then I have to flesh it out over all the panels and stuff like that. And I think that is that's a really easy misconception for a lot of people who aren't writers to have about the creative process, that it's just about the idea. Right. But no, it's actually about the execution. The execution is where the idea actually, like, finds flesh, right, and makes sense. But I could also, I must say, I thought you guys actually treat Stan Lee very fairly. Like, I never once felt like I was playing the bad guy or anything like that. I never felt like I was playing some sort of cynical, you know, fake fiend who's you know, just manipulating things behind the scenes and trying to steal.
Sort of Mandarin.
Right. Ben Kingsley, right?
No, and there's that terrific climactic scene that you and Steven have at the end where Stan and Jack confront each other. I guess that's supposed to take place in the mid 80s at some
point. A dream.
The liminal space of the 80s.
Yes.
Where basically both of you get the, you know, air your dirty laundry about this stuff. And I think both I think it does. It gives both sides honest, sincere point of view.
Yeah, and I gotta say, like, as a writer myself, the older I get, and the further in one's career you get as a writer, like, I feel like I'm more like a Kirby a lot of times, and I'm trying to find those Stan Lee instincts in myself. Like, it's a balance you've got to find as a creative. In a lot of ways, their dynamic kind of works as an intern. There are two comic book creators inside of each of us, the Stan Lee and Jack Kirby.
Warring for dominance.
Right. Which one do you feed, right?
The business side is really important, especially, you know, these days when content is king. You've got to make that kind of persona. Because Fred's right. Like, how do you ever compete with that in the end? Like, yeah. Stan Lee TM is a real hard juggernaut, pun intended.
That is the one thing that Stan Lee indubitably created, was Stan Lee.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Kirby had this era, you know, some people could, I mean, it comes across sometimes in the play as naivete, but fundamentally it was an era, it was an arrogance born of genius. He thought he could just keep creating, and everything he did, because he had done Captain American Romance and then Fantastic Four, he thought he could just keep creating. What he ran into was somebody like Stan Lee, who the minute he saw this big thing going on, wrapped both arms and legs around it and was like, mine, you know, and just kind of stuck with it. And Kirby thought he could walk away from that, but Lee never did. Lee's creative output ends in 1969, essentially 68. And he kind of rode that into the history books.
There's also a fun artistic kind of question, in the sense that, comic books, as they say, it wasn't supposed to last. It wasn't, they couldn't see what all these things would become. And
they were embarrassed by it.
Jack loved the work. He lost himself in the work so much. Stan had so much outside time and had more, was more an executive and more of the suit with his upbringing and taking over and all these sorts of things. So he had a little bit more time to contemplate the possibilities of what things could become and how does that relationship work out? The other thing I think is kind of interesting, which I realized from 2014 as after we did the show, as time progressed and we were on panels, probably something that made me tear up was we were at San Diego Comic-Con, I think the first time, and we were on this beautiful panel with, the creator of
Mark
Blade.
Evanier.
Yeah, and with Mark Evanier and the
creator. Darwin Cook was on that panel. Great Darwin Cook.
So many great, amazing people were on this panel, and they all talked about Jack and they all knew Jack.
Marv Wolfman.
Marv Wolfman described being 13, I think, and what would happen is that when you were young and you wanted to break into comics, you would drive up to their house in San Diego, and
Marv Wolfman, that was Long Island.
Whatever location, because I've heard it in San Diego too, and I wrote, in Long Island with this story, and Roz would be like, "What do you want to eat?" You know, and she would make them tuna fish sandwiches. And they would sit and they would watch Jack draw and they would ask him questions. So there was something about this couple that I was learning about through these panels. They were mentors. And that's just something you don't hear about from the other family and the other side. Not that they were encouraging and like, you know, do a great job, but true mentorship. And so I think where Jack wins is that there's this legacy of comic book artists born out of conversations with him, studying with him, wanting to do take for in fact Fernando, who draws Heat Fighter, is working on another comic book, and right away he's using Kirby dots and he's like, the Kirby is intentional. Like, that never dies. That is so strong that even if they hadn't won the lawsuit, there is something he's done with his artwork with artists that the new generations are bringing it forward. It's really, really inspiring.
In a lot of ways, I feel like Stan Lee was a master at creating fans, whereas Jack Kirby was a master of creating like that legacy that he wasn't seeing financially, but he created a legacy of art. Like, nobody says, well, I draw this the Stan Lee way. No one does that. that's not a thing. But people go like, oh, yeah, the Kirby hand. Like, that's so there's something, I think there's something as an artist, I think there's something far more real and lasting to that and to Jack's work and his legacy of mentorship. And people see what Jack Kirby did and want to do it. Like my 6-year-old daughter, I've like, you know, you can't, you have to look at this, but you can't open it. But she's drawing, I mean, they're delightful. They're about a werewolf girl. She's drawing her own comic books right now. And that makes me very happy. So I'm trying to expose her to like other artists, but I can't say like, oh, well, here's a contract that Stan Lee drew up one time. Like that, good business, but who cares?
Licensing, kid, licensing.
Licensing.
I mean, like, obviously you should care and it's important, but it's not, to me, that's not where the heart is. And that's a thing that Steven gets to talk about. Like it's where the fire is, where the heart is. Like that's a, he felt all of those things and he made us feel those things.
I love how you talked about the fans, Joe, but how, and that's the thing he does. Every time you read one of his, like the captions and how he talks, he just pierces through the panels like, hey, friend. And it really feels not like audio drama, like he's talking to you. And mm-hmm. there is a quality that he got with that. You know, that was great, but it's more entrepreneurship with, yeah. the, you know, that
right.
Work.
Yeah. And well, like,
I mean, it's clear that Kirby's work has stood the test of time, and it's kind of gratifying knowing through the work that you guys have done what kind of person he was. I think he would be pleased to know that, you know, decades and decades later, we're still talking about and appreciating his work, and that his work and his life has inspired your piece of artwork, you know, with this play, now audio drama. So just to wind things up here, you know, of course this was in the past for you guys. What are you currently working on? First, let me just kind of go around the horn and start with Bobby, and you know, what kind of creative projects are you involved in right now?
Well, since COVID stopped everything, that was supposed to, I was supposed to have 3 productions around the world this year and a concert in London. And those didn't happen. So I actually turned one of my pieces into a digital film that was completely done in quarantine when each actor was in their own space. And it's taking many months to edit, but it's like a sort of supernatural, kids with psychic abilities, and they go into this underworld. It's like Goonies meet Stranger Things. And it's called Psych Kids. And so that took up a lot of my time because I could do that digitally. I could score it all digitally as well. And then, you know, this gift came my way at a time that I really needed something creative. I feel like more of a, like this year has been like contracts and just like getting things up in order. And so when this creatively came, it's funny, just listening to everything that everyone's been saying, it's really cool because everything that you all said recently is what I tried to bring in the music. Steve, your performance, the drive of it and the honesty and the relationship with Roz, like that was, to me, that was my hook in. And when I first heard the scene where you come up with the idea the first time of taking everything that you knew as a kid and turning it into, that to me, I was like, well, that's the superhero. He's the superhero. It's everything that's inside of him. And maybe if I had been traveling around the world, I wouldn't have been as meticulous with the score. But yeah, so that's what, and hopefully when everything comes back, Crystal and I have a play that I am scoring that is supposed to go to London. And we'll see. It's all just kind of wait and see.
Very cool. Tim, how about you?
I have been occupying a lot of my time with Dungeons and Dragons, playing it, streaming it on Twitch, painting minis, writing third-party content, adventures and stuff, and putting it up for sale on the DMs Guild. That's kind of what I've been spending my quarantine year doing. So, yeah, other, you know, I have other creative irons in the fire, but that's kind of what I've been focusing on lately.
Excellent. Amy?
What have I been doing? Yeah. Okay. So what have I been doing? I've just recorded my commercial voiceover demo. That's in post. So that's kind of exciting. My one good closet is getting ready to be turned into some kind of janky sound booth. We'll see how well that goes in Washington Heights. I am almost done with what I think is going to be the final pass on a sweet Christmas rom-com novel that I started for NaNoWriMo in 2016 as a way to deal with the election, and the rewrites have been done during pandemic, so it feels kind of cyclical getting it done. And other than that, I shot a feature, a crazy little feature that we shot, believe it or not, in 2 days. That during the last couple of months, the director/producer managed to get that finished, sent out to a whole bunch of little festivals, and that's been ranking stuff up. So I'm kind of excited that I had anything on IMDb for 2020. But yeah, it's more like watching things come in and going, oh, that happened, or oh, that's going on, or watching TV and going, my friend, I miss people. Look at my friend on television. So that's what I've been doing.
Very cool. Matt?
I'm a novelist as well. I'm a horror writer, and I've got two books coming out on Macmillan's new horror imprint, Nightfire. So I'm finishing up the third draft of the first one right now. It's in fact right behind my laptop screen, staring at me in the face with its judgmental eyes. So that comes out, I think, July of next year. And then the second book will come out, hopefully, the year after, if I can finish that one up. And that's been eating up the bulk of my brain. I have some other fun news that I can't talk about yet, so I won't tell you that. But I'm involved in a podcast audio drama company as well called Gideon Media. With another Brick playwright alum, Mac Rogers, because we are a very incestuous scene. So we've got a couple things on that end also coming out soon, but I don't know if I can name the details yet, but you can go to gideonmedia.com and find out when we can announce those details. So mostly the book and then things shrouded in mystery.
Excellent. Joe?
I have a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, two girls. So that's keeping me pretty busy. I work for, I'm in my office now. I'm a scene shop supervisor for NYU. So for the last year, I haven't done any of my job because there is no shows to build. So I'm not building any shows. So, on the upside, I've been staying busy, randomly supervising classes, like all the college courses that require video link. I sort of reverted back to your high school AV club friend who sets up the projector, basically what I've been doing. And then as far
you have
as
a wallet chain when you do it too.
No, but I do have my keys on a lanyard. Does that count?
That's perfect. Same diff.
That counts. There's been this weird renaissance with old friends from college at Syracuse University. A friend of mine who's an author. She started putting together these ridiculous. Let's all do a Zoom stage reading, completely unofficial, of various screenplays and films that we love from like the 80s and 90s. So, you know, I think this weekend we're going to do Stand By Me.
Awesome.
I'll be playing the Corey Feldman role.
Yeah, you will.
Yeah, not remotely appropriate at all age-wise or anything, but you know, just kind of it becomes a bunch of people in their 40s very drunk like reading, yelling at their computers at 1 a.m. So that's been a lot of fun. But
I had to get very creative with our spare time in the last year, that's for sure. And then Stephen, yeah. I know I speak for all of Venture Brothers Nation in lamenting that we won't be hearing from Dr. Orpheus at least officially anytime soon. But what else have you got going on?
Well, they shut down the theaters,
So as my my mom used to say in her best Brooklyn accent, you're a bum. You're a bum. You don't do anything. I was working on a musical of the light of Joy Mangano. And if you saw the movie Joy about the woman who invented the Miracle Mop, which was just wonder, extraordinary music. It's just really, really great. Right before the pandemic hit. And then, yeah, they closed down the theaters. The next project I'm gonna work on, as all these theaters struggle to figure out how to put on a play with this new medium. I mean, even working it out with the unions and stuff, how do we stream a play? So the playwright, actor David Greenspan wrote a new play called The Memory Motel that the Two River Theater in New Jersey is doing. Just going to start in, I think, in a couple of weeks. But it's, I have no idea how we're going to do it, you know, in under the pandemic. I know it's going to be somehow over, you know, mediated over the internet in some way. So it'll be exciting to see what happens with that. So that's the next actual show I have to do, which I'm excited about.
Fantastic. And finally, the volcano of creative activity that is the Fred and Crystal experience. What do you guys have on deck?
Well, we live together, so we don't get to rest because we can do things together. And Fred can run and be like, I have this idea.
It's
like,
so hard.
It's like, I'm trying to sleep. Oh, no, it's fun. It's like a creative treehouse in our world. We actually got a print copy of our story from Adventure Time recently, so that was nice to get in the mail. It'd be exciting. And a
boom comic
very
book
specific
version of
Princess
Adventure Time.
Bubblegum, edition, and which we loved. And we have written Eat Fighter. We workshopped that a bit with some actors as we were working, including Joe, as we were hearing that out loud. And it's been
that's optioned. Being shopped around by Webtoon, the publisher, as a cartoon.
So hopefully, that would be great. We really love that cartoon.
And speaking of cartoons, right now, if you enjoyed this sort of look into comics history, my fellow Syracuse alum Ryan Dunleavy and I are currently doing the comic book history of animation, which is coming up from IDW right now.
Yep. And the play that Bobby mentioned is called Rain Zoe Save the World. It's about teenage activists. Drew and Dane Productions. We are in works with a possible production in the next year and a half when theaters come up. So we've kind of got to keep on task for that, even though there's all these other things. And what else? Oh, yes. I have a new audio drama series that I'm working on called The Magician's Magician, which will be coming out from Boom Integrated. And so there's been a lot of incestuous brick action.
Different Boom than the Boom that does the Adventure
Yes,
Time
different
comics.
Boom. I'm in the Writers Guild Audio Alliance, and so I'm in there with Gideon. So I don't get titles of what's being cooked up, but I get to hear a lot of things. And just a little fun thing that people can listen to while they're waiting in audition would be, as a teacher, I still teach with a theater development fund, and they did something quite extraordinary. They went online, so I appear every other hour for 40 minutes, and it's actually more efficient. I know everyone's really sad about schools, but I gotta be honest, I've been in schools before and we got like 15 minutes in before. So to sing out the talents of our members here, they have all seen Indecent. They've studied Indecent, and it's been a big deal for them on Broadway HD. So that's something.
Can you tell them why you're bringing up Indecent?
Oh, because of Stephen Ratazzi being in, one of the incredible, ensemble members that is an ensemble show. It's really helped young theater makers and writers, and also studying the audio drama Steal the Stars, written by Mac Rogers, which we actually do in depth. Both shows we actually go in depth because they have the script and they also look at certain scenes. So both in terms of their drama.
And why is that important?
That's important because Nat Cassidy wrote the book of it. And I think you are actually the novelization of Steal the Stars. And also, Nat, are you in? You're in the series.
I am. I'm Lloyd, the scientist, the lovable scientist.
Oh, Lloyd.
That's so cool.
Poor Lloyd.
So to surprise you, you know, you've been corrupting the youth everywhere.
You're all touching lives.
Yep. And teenagers still want to write plays.
Well, fantastic.
I'd like to keep doing them.
You're here.
So I want to thank all of you for inviting me to your 7 years after the fact cast party for the absolutely stellar, great production of King Kirby. It was great on the stage. It's great on the audio cast. Whether you're a diehard comics geek like me or just somebody that's interested in a really cool, well-written and well-performed piece of contemporary theater, I hope everybody gets to enjoy this. My name is Rob Salkowitz. You can follow my stuff on Forbes or follow me on Twitter at Rob Salk. And again, thank you so much for all of this. I hope everybody enjoys the performance.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.